Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode 112. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure being here with you, Jay. Yeah, 112. And today we're looking for data. Apparently everybody has it and everybody's losing it. So yeah, we're going to cover a few stories where people just can't seem to place their data correctly or safely. And yeah, that's causing some issues.
Very private data this time around. Probably the most intimate data we'll be talking about, I think, from the history of the podcast. I mean, we talk about company data, which we're definitely going to talk about today because there's a pretty big story around that, but also very personal data that affects not just enterprises, but, you know, general people as well. So we have three stories to get into. And the first is about Troy Hunt from Have I Been Pwned, which is especially interesting, that illustrates that sometimes something negative can happen to the best of us.
Absolutely. So Troy Hunt is the creator behind Have I Been Pwned. I assume everybody knows what that is. It's a website where you can check for your credentials being part of some data dump somewhere. It's actually pretty useful. Probably at this point, everybody is present in one dump or another. So yeah, there's that. And just recently, I believe this week, Troy Hunt came out and he was actually pretty transparent about this. And he was the victim of a phishing attack. And yeah, you can say that it's ironic that the person behind the website where we see and learn about phishing incidents and data breaches actually gets breached himself and has his data from his own newsletter breached into the open.
Yeah, and this is why I never will ever say that I'm invincible from this or that I'm above this, because literally not one single person is. I mean, you could have the best security person on the planet and just has a, you know, that individual has a bad day or a temporary lapse in judgment, which happens to all of us at some point or another. And the transparency is really great, because I think that as unfortunate as this is, it's a learning opportunity for a lot of people to realize that there's, you know, we say that there's no 100% security, and there really isn't. And that's also true of security researchers. I mean, I've come close a number of times. YouTubers get a lot of phishing scams and emails. I mean, I see it probably several times a month, and there was one that I almost clicked on. Thankfully, I didn't. I realized at the last minute that it was a little sketchy, and then I aborted everything. But yeah, like I said, it can happen to the best of us.
It's usually very close when you realize that it's actually a phishing attempt. I think I've mentioned this in the podcast before, but about 10 years ago, I was expecting a package, and for some reason, I got a phishing attempt from the delivery company. Apparently, it was coming from the delivery company that had the package. Mm-hmm. Just a coincidence. And I was this close. I had my mouse cursor right on top of the link when my brain kicked in and, wait a minute, how do they get my email? And yeah, it was a phishing email, and it just happened to be at the exact right moment at the exact right time. And sometimes you're caught off guard by these things. And yeah, this is exactly what happened to Troy Hunt. So he runs a MailChimp account. MailChimp is an email service. It's used very much by companies that have newsletters and that have outreach emails and all of that. So he runs a newsletter through MailChimp, and he received a very well-crafted message, apparently coming from MailChimp, telling him that his account was blocked from sending emails due to some restriction or another, and that he had to actually go in, log in, verify his account so that it could be restored. When you're in that position, when you rely on that as part of your business, you kind of get into danger mode and you need to fix the problem. And it's an important issue that you need to address. And this happened to be worded in such a way that it wasn't overly dramatic. It actually looked legit, like you just have a problem in your account and you need to log in to fix that problem. It wasn't, this is the end of the world and you need to fix your account problem. It just had the right amount of urgency to it. And he says that he was tired, his was very late, and it caught him off guard, and he clicked that, and he typed in his credentials, and he typed in his two-factor authentication code. So he essentially handed everything in. And, yep, the attackers got the information, went back to the actual login site for MailChimp, used the credentials, and got into his account. The end result, almost 16,000 email addresses and geolocation information and names that were leaked. And adding insult to injury, about half of those were from people that had at some point been subscribed to the newsletter, but no longer were. And MailChimp was not sending them the emails, but had not deleted the information.
It's going to be a trend in today's episode.
Yeah. Keeping information when you shouldn't is going to be the trend for today. It's the story that ties all of these stories together. So there are a few things that are very interesting here. First is what you mentioned before, that even seasoned professionals, even cybersecurity professionals and cybersecurity people with a very strong background in cybersecurity and very knowledgeable about this, they also fall for this. So when you see your account manager or your whoever at your company that's not IT related, that is not doing IT related job, fall for something like this, yeah, he does, because this is a very sophisticated type of attack. You might seem that, oh, he's just clicking an email and that's just silly and you'll never fall for that. Yeah, you do. Everybody does. And that's the point of phishing. That's why it works. That's why threat actors still use phishing even 20 years after it was invented or 25 years after it was invented. It's very sophisticated and it's only getting more and more with AI and with something called phishing as a service. Just as we've discussed previously for malware as a service and ransomware as a service, everything is a service these days. What this does is that it lowers the barrier to entry. You don't need to know all the intricate details of how these things operate. You don't need to know the email protocols by heart. You don't need to know how to code. You go to a dark web service, and I'm just mentioning dark web service here as in an ominous way, but it's not exactly that. You just go to a website, you register, you get your phishing kit, and you just start filling in the blanks and sending emails everywhere. And some people will fall for it.
A lot of them are, I mean, almost all of them nowadays are very, you know, they look accurate. I remember getting a text about an unpaid toll, and I just so happened to have traveled within the past year. And it's like, oh, you need to pay this toll. Oh, really? So I Google it, and apparently a bunch of people are getting the same fraudulent unpaid toll text. It was actually a super large campaign that was going around that made the news. As soon as I Googled for it, I saw that I wasn't the only one getting this. And then I got like three or four more of them. They were kind of relentless. And then you mentioned, you know, a shipment. I've had phishing scams, coincidentally, from DHL, which I don't, I don't normally order or have anything shipped through there, but I also have a history of, you know, ordering things from overseas, so DHL is often what's used for that. So, you know, I would get a text or an email saying that a package is held in customs or something like that, and I need to authorize it or something like that. And it looks very legit, and most of them do, which is why we really should never click on links in email ever. I mean, even if you get like a message from your bank or especially your bank about a notice or something like that, you got to type it in manually. You got to open up a browser, type the name of your bank.com, go there, and then go into your account, look at your notices, make sure you actually have one. And I think at this point, it's safe to say under no circumstances should you click a link in an email unless you were, you know, absolutely expecting it. Like you log into a service and it says, we're going to send you an email to verify your login. Okay, you were expecting that, but just anything else, I'm even like sketchy with those kinds of emails too. But today's day and age, links in email are extremely dangerous. I would even go as far as to just disable that in your email client just to show everything in raw text and, you know, still don't copy and paste it, because what you'll see is, you know, you could see google.com and it's G-O-0-G-L-E or something like that. And if you're not really looking at it, it looks like maybe a fluctuation in the font or something, and not necessarily, you know, it looks benign, but you're like, that one character kind of seems to be a little off, and that's a warning sign. But that's not something you can live or die by, because, you know, again, you especially crafted URLs and the way that they're constructed and the tricks that threat actors are using to put text behind text. I mean, we've seen all kinds of tactics during this podcast, and any one of them can be in your email.
One of the things that you should always do is, like you said, never click those email links, and always go directly to the websites and type in the addresses yourself, the URLs yourself. I was actually surprised when we were going through them, through the actual stories that we're basing off. They mentioned very low numbers for phishing attempts. They talk about just 1 million attacks in the first 2 months of 2025. That sounds awfully low for what we actually see out in the field. And one phishing attempt per second, which is ridiculously low. There's many, many orders of magnitude more than that. I don't know what type of filters they're using to get this information, what they're actually considering a phishing attempt or not, but the numbers are massively more than that. It's 5 or 6 zeros ahead of that. And it's never going to stop as long as it's successful, and it doesn't have to be successful 99% of the time, or even 99.999% of the time. As long as someone clicks on that email link, it's enough. AI made it much, much easier. Nowadays, you can craft emails that are perfectly written, no, the usual telltale signs, the grammatical errors, the weird sentences, all of that. You don't get that anymore. The phishing emails are perfectly written, just as if they were from the actual companies. Everything looks legit. They might even pull the images from the actual correct URLs and show you the actual logos from the companies, and just one tiny link there where they want you to click is the actual phishing link. It's almost impossible to tell these emails just by looking at them. Blocking links is probably the safest way to go, but there are also other ways to do phishing emails. One technique that has been used recently is through QR codes embedded into the emails. And in that situation, you don't even have to click the link. If you're using your phone in front of your computer and you happen to have the email open in the back, as soon as the camera from your phone picks it up, it's very likely the phone is going to ask you if you want to open that URL. And you're going to say yes, because, yeah, it's a new URL. It's something that I want to see. And now you're done. You've accessed the link, and yeah. There are many new ways that this is improving. As long as there's money to be made from this attack, it's going to continue. And like I said before, the barrier to entry, it's ridiculously low right now. You actually have to have some skills in coding, in understanding protocols, and all of that. And right now, you don't need any of it. You just need to find the right website where you can get the service. And yeah, that's the entire thing.
A lot of times I wonder if just most of these go unreported because, you know, if Joe in apartment 6 is the victim of a phishing email, nobody cares. It doesn't make news. You know, they just, you know, submits a fraud claim. But as soon as it hits somebody famous or somebody in the media, then it gets attention. But I think sometimes it's just luck of the draw who it hits. If it hits the wrong person, it gets reported. If it doesn't, if it just hits the general public, then, you know, it's probably not even barely newsworthy to some of these clickbait news sites, and it doesn't get reported. I would agree with you that there's a lot more out there than what's being reported on.
But by a lot. I was very, very surprised with the extremely low numbers that were reported on these stories. Incredibly low for what's actually out there. Again, this is from anecdotal evidence. We are not actually counting emails that go through and are considered phishing attempts. But these numbers are absolutely lowballing it. The other important point about this story, and this is where this segues into the next one, is the part about MailChimp not deleting the data. When people unsubscribe from the newsletter, they are not expecting their data to be retained. But MailChimp was maintaining that data, and it was keeping that accessible. And that was still accessible to Troy Hunt through his account, meaning that, okay, I'm not sending them the emails, but I still have access to those emails. They are still in the system. And a very important point for all of the stories that we're going to be discussing today is that the information that you don't retain cannot be stolen. If you're retaining more information than what you need, and you have a security problem, that information can be stolen and has been stolen. So data minimization, it's the name of the thing that you should be looking for. You should only ever keep the data that you actually need. And when you no longer need it, you should be sure to dispose of it. Which is not just a good security practice, but is also part of the law. If you're doing business in Europe, for example, GDPR has some paragraphs about this. You should not keep more data than what you actually need, and you should not keep it for longer than you need it. That's a pretty important point. Again, it's not just good practice from a data security standpoint, but also just reducing your exposure to risk when you have an incident in your hands.
I wonder why they were retaining email addresses for unsubscribed users. I wonder what the use case is, other than, you know, the negligence, but it seems weird to me.
User profiling, for sure. And another piece of interesting information that is actually out there, which is just the textbook definition of personally identifiable information, is your DNA makeup. So 23andMe, the company that offers you DNA mapping services and tells you your ancestry and from where your ancestors were in the world and all of that. So in 2023, they had this very large data breach. About 7 million records from customers were stolen. And then it was found on dark web forums that parts of that information were being offered for sale. The tricky part there is that it was being specifically targeting certain ethnicities and people of certain backgrounds. And yeah, it gets pretty dark pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But the company never really recovered from that incident. And right now they have filed for bankruptcy protection. And the reason this is important is that the data that they have right now still exists. You still have the data accessible to 23andMe and through all of the studies that rely on 23andMe for their data sources. And that data being out there, when the company goes out of business, that's a problem because it might be acquired by somebody else. It might be part of a merger, part of an acquisition. The company just goes under and nobody is protecting the data anymore. The whatever agreement you signed with them saying how the data could be used no longer is in effect because the company doesn't exist anymore. That's a potential problem for a lot of people. And that has really dark consequences.
It really does. Yeah, it's kind of incredible because it hits home a little bit because I believe my data is on there too. But in my defense, like I normally wouldn't upload anything like that or even consider it. But, you know, personally, I was looking for my long lost sister that was adopted out. And I figured this would be a good way to find her. I did find her, which is great. But unfortunately now, you know, my data is in question and I have to weigh the consequences of that and delete the account and hope that they actually delete it. Like it's one thing to click a button that says delete data, but you don't have access to their servers to go in there and double check that your data is missing. I mean, we just don't really know. And worse, they could say that it is and it's not. And I'm pretty sure from the article, they're saying that according to their user agreement, that they're going to still keep some of that, if not all of it, which is pretty bad.
Yeah, that's pretty bad, and that's probably not even legal in some jurisdictions. Definitely keeping personally identifiable information when the user requests its deletion is absolutely against GDPR, but I'm not a lawyer. And that's actually one of the problems. Apparently in the US, most states don't have specific regulation to enforce when there's issues with DNA information. There are just 4 or 5 states in the US that have regulations about this, California being one. So in those states, this information is actually less protected than other types of information that you might upload, like your financial information and all of that. So your DNA, which is absolutely personally identifiable information, is not even protected under any law in most states in the US. And I would think that's a problem. That's a problem for all the users of this website. Like you said, right now, with the company's future on the line, the best course of action if you have data there is to request it to be deleted. But like you said, in their terms of service, they will still retain some of that information even after you request the deletion, which is amazing. But apparently that's what you signed up for when you use the website. So you should request the deletion. It's a multi-step process. You need to go into your account. You need to ask it to delete the information. Then you need to go to another part of the website and request the information that was part of other studies to also be deleted. There are a few steps to this. And in the end of all of this, those steps being done, you still have information with 23andMe that you have no recourse and no way of deleting. Again, if the company is already in trouble financially, this won't help them at all because they will get sued to get that information removed from there. So whatever assets they might have, as soon as the bankruptcy protection is off, those are on the table again. They will absolutely be sued from people in Europe over this.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely will. And sometimes it's just baffling that, you know, how, you know, the stupidity with some of the companies out there. It's like literally saying, yeah, we're going to retain some of the information as if nobody thought that they might get sued. Like, it just seems like common sense. I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but we've seen people get sued for less than this, far less than this. And they've already been sued. They had the breach. They had lawsuits because of the breach. And then they say they're going to retain some information, not thinking they're going to get more lawsuits. And they're already going to be on the receiving end of a massive fine. So I just don't understand how anybody with half a brain can just publicly say, we're going to keep some of your information and not expect some ramifications from that. It's just weird to me. Like you guys, you've been sued a bunch of times. I don't think you should be tempting lawyers at this point.
You're storing DNA information. You already suffered a massive breach that made public 7 million records, and you still don't have proper data processes in place for users to get rid of that. I mean, that's just inviting further lawsuits and further litigation. This is the epitome. I cannot stress this enough. This is the epitome of personally identifiable information. There's absolutely no argument that can be made that DNA or your genetic makeup is not personally identifiable information. It absolutely is. And the courts have accepted DNA as evidence and this proof of being the victim or the author of a given crime for years now, for decades now that this has been accepted. This is absolutely personally identifiable information. And that's the most important type of information, the one that has the broadest protections under GDPR, for example, under the UK data protection laws, under California law, but unfortunately not all states have that. It will be interesting if some states, people from some states will get some type of compensation for this and in other states they won't. I don't know exactly how the class action lawsuits work in the US, but I would assume that could not happen. I would really, really find it interesting if just by being in a different state you get nothing out of this.
I wouldn't be surprised either. And I would also say that even if someone is in a state that has no protections, the lawsuits from the states that do will far outweigh it anyway, and then more than make up for it because, you know, they're not going to be protected from every single place that, you know, has people that gave up their data. So all it takes is, you know, maybe the GDPR or individual states that do have these protections, and then the lawsuits will bury them so far under. It's just going to be amazing. I think the only thing more shocking than this is if they don't get more lawsuits. I think it's pretty obvious at this point that they almost certainly will.
And if they end up being acquired by some other company or just having to sell their assets, this is an asset for them. This is considered valuable, and other companies will try to acquire this. What I said before, that the data might be transferred to another company that does not uphold the restrictions that 23andMe had on the data usage. They might just use it for whatever. That's also a problem. Even if it doesn't get leaked, even if it doesn't become part of another breach like it happened in 2023, just that data alone, by existing, first, it's an incredible target for threat actors. Who wouldn't want the genetic makeup of millions of individuals? That's valuable. That has value. And secondly, this becomes valuable pretty quickly for companies. This becomes just another asset. And that's a problem when you start treating this type of information as just another asset. It becomes valuable. Lots of deals are made every single day. We might suspect that the data is stored by a company and then next week is stored by another. Different regulations, different terms of service agreements and all of that. Again, really tricky situation. If you have an account with them, please follow those recommendations. Please log in, ask for the data to be deleted. This is actually a manual step that you need to do. You will receive an email confirmation, apparently. You have to accept that, confirm it by email. You have to go back again and check all the other places where the different parts of the data are used and stored and ask for that to be deleted as well. They really don't make it easy for you. And even then, something will remain. But do try to get out as much of the data as possible because you don't know where this will end up.
Yeah, that email verification thing worries me because that seems like a phishing gold mine. You know, if they have a breach and they have a list of all the users and they could find out if the data was requested, it would be child's play to craft a, you know, confirmation email just for that reason. That's totally bogus. I mean, it's like this is a gold mine in many different categories for threat actors of many different kinds, like phishing emails and all these different things. It's pretty incredible. Like the more you think about it, the more you'll think about possibilities for this to be an even bigger problem than it already is.
What do you mean phishing? It's almost as if we just talked about a different story about phishing.
That I know. Doesn't
happen. Nobody falls for that. And another thing that apparently nobody falls for is having an Oracle Cloud Security account. So there's this claim by CloudSec, a company, a cybersecurity company. They have cybersecurity services and all of that. And they came out a few days ago into the open with a report stating that Oracle Cloud had been breached and there were lots of customer information out in the open for sale. And Oracle was very, very quick in coming out and saying that that was not true. There was no such breach. And yeah, that's just made up. To which CloudSec replied, yeah, it is. Here are the evidence. Here are the proofs. This is the detailed analysis of what happened. This is where your information is being sold. This is the endpoint that was abused and all of that. You can actually look up CloudSec. That's Cloud S-E-K. Cloud S-E-K. Just Google that up. You'll find the report. It's the first or second link that you find on Google. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty technical. It actually gives you lots of details about this. And yeah, even though Oracle is denying this, apparently this is true and this actually happened. There are a few hundred thousand records out there from customers that used that endpoint that was compromised. This was a single sign-on endpoint. It resided on actual Oracle Cloud infrastructure. So it has all the hallmarks of actually being legit and having been compromised, in fact, being compromised. And again, it's a vulnerability that was exploited and the attackers were paying attention. They got in, they got the data. It's interesting that the attacker behind this, or the supposed attacker behind this, was actually asking for help in decrypting the passwords, which is interesting if you look at this, because as we just talked about phishing as a service and malware as a service and all of that, now it's decryption as a service. He was looking for decryption as a service. Essentially, those GPU farms that are mining Bitcoins out there, they can take a pause and just look at passwords and crack passwords just as easily.
And this is the kind of thing that could end up under the review of government. When you have a company saying that there wasn't a breach, they lie, assuming they did lie, they allegedly lied, and then if that comes out that they did lie, then they have some answering to do, both from a legal perspective and a, you know, government perspective, because, you know, these things need to be disclosed, and to flat out deny something just to try to save face. You know, the people that do security research, you know, they don't sleep, right? They're on this. They look at everything. They're Googling everything. They're finding, you know, like you said, the person's asking for help. So they find that, and they find, you know, this links to that and this links to that. And then it paints a very clear picture. It's really not the kind of thing that you can deny. I mean, you can deny it all day long, but, you know, the minute something like this is in the news, probably within 5 minutes or less, people are digging right then and there. Security researchers, you know, they love puzzles. They love to figure things out. They love to do detective work, and that's exactly what they're going to do. And they're going to figure out, you know, what's connected to what in a pretty short order. And just like you said, there's obvious signs. I mean, the SSO and the usual suspects when it comes to the signs to look for. So again, we say allegedly breached, but at the same time, I feel like the evidence and the connections that are being made here makes it hard to believe otherwise.
I mean, Oracle continues to deny it, but a small company, and small compared to Oracle, obviously, like CloudSec, if they come out and they accuse Oracle of something, if it happens to not be true, if Oracle in fact was not breached, if this didn't really happen, then CloudSec has no further reputation in cybersecurity. And in this industry, that's actually all that you have is your reputation. So the moment that goes out the window, you go out of business. So I really don't think that they would come out with something as strong as this against Oracle without really good evidence behind it and some backing on what they're saying. And if you look at the report, it looks like the evidence is there.
It really does. And it'd be interesting if this turns out that it's indeed true, then what Oracle might say afterwards, oh yeah, we've been caught. Oh yeah, we lied. Like, I'm sure that's not what they're going to say, but it's just, part of me wonders, as big as Oracle is, they feel like they could survive a little damage from, you know, not telling the truth, hoping to get away with it. But again, that's just conjecture on my part. I have no idea, you know, what happens behind the closed doors of a boardroom meeting or whatever meetings they might be having when they, you know, decide to come forward and either deny or accept. Like any other company, there's an internal plan, there's a conversation. We see lots of companies that, you know, sit on this information for a very long time while the information's leaked. Other companies like Oracle just come out and say that it didn't happen. Or sometimes we have companies that are responsible that admit it right away and take ownership of it and try to, you know, keep their reputation by just being honest, which would go a lot further in this situation, because Oracle being a big company, they could survive a bit of damage, but at the same time, a reputation hit for them. You know, someone wants to go with their cloud service and then find out that they lied about a breach, they'd be less likely to go with them. So in this case, it's like honesty is the only way to save yourself. It just is, but apparently they might not know that.
Again, reputation in this industry is everything. CrowdStrike is never going to let that incident from last year go away. That's never going to be disassociated from them anymore. So that will always be a stain on their name. And CloudSec would not risk the same thing happening with them coming out with something like this, at least assuming everybody is acting rationally here. As somebody's mentioning on the chat, this was unpatched software. This was an unpatched SSO endpoint that, again, was just sitting there with updates that should have been applied and weren't. Again, I cannot stress this enough. If you have problems applying your patches, if you don't want the disruption, please reach out. We at TechScare, we love doing that. We can help you with that.
Yep.
Don't leave your security endpoints out there in the open without receiving your updates. You need the updates applied every single time, not just for security endpoints, for authentication endpoints like this, but for every single service that's internet facing or even internal, if it's critical enough and you deem it warranted. You really need to apply your patches as soon as they're out. Keeping stuff, especially internet facing stuff, unpatched for months, apparently, as this was the case, there's no other way that this situation can end. It will always end like this. You will always be breached. It will always be exploited. It might not be today, it might be tomorrow, but there's absolutely no other scenario. There's no other way that this scenario plays out other than you being breached.
Yeah, it's funny. I'll just mention this. Learn Linux TV proudly has 98% uptime, not 100, not 99. I was just checking the other day of all my systems, and the uptime average is 98%, because when it all comes down to it, it's a lot easier to patch a system and reboot it. And I have live patching and I still reboot because I'm that into it. But It's a lot easier to update a system and reboot it and inconvenience users than it is to completely rebuild your infrastructure. That's the alternative, okay? So I'm okay with a few people complaining that the website is down. And sure, I know there's retail organizations out there that, you know, would lose a lot of money by being down for just a few minutes. But still, you know, I proudly have 98% uptime because at the end of the day, like I said, it's a lot less work to rebuild all of my infrastructure than it is to patch and reboot. It takes me less than 5 minutes often to patch and reboot a server. It could take all day to rebuild it. So when it all comes down to it, I mean, that's what we're up against. And, you know, to your point, you got to patch. And yes, it's an inconvenience to both the system administrators, the CTOs, and the users. But a system being down for, and we've seen this many times, sometimes 3 weeks or more, just to try to go through a system, especially if it's breached. I mean, that's a lot more downtime, and that's what you're trying to avoid.
Because again, going back to CloudSec's allegations, there's already third-party validation on this, not just from CloudSec. There are independent security experts looking at this. There's this quote, there's direct evidence that the threat actor was able to upload data to the web root of a login server that was being actively used. I mean, this is the smoking gun. If you have evidence of this, then that was compromised. There's no two ways to look at this. Again, you can say no every single time that you went. You can scream at the top of your lungs that this didn't happen, but reality doesn't really care.
Reality doesn't care about your delusions.
Okay, so again, you should be transparent about your breaches. This stuff happens. It's like the phishing attempt on Troyhunt, and that was successful. This happens to everybody. This happens to every single company. You can take all the best possible measures. You can do your patching. You can be on top of everything. And there's still a risk that something like this might happen. It might be a vulnerability that nobody knows about, that somebody is using against you. It might be some mistake in a configuration file somewhere. There's always something. There's always an excuse. There's always a reason why this stuff happens. You need to make it as difficult as possible, not miss out on the easy stuff like patching your services and patching your systems. But there is still always a risk. It's never zero. If somebody promises that you will never be breached, that there's zero risk of an exploit, that person is lying. Please look for somebody, some other vendor. There's always a risk. There's always something that can go wrong. But you need to make it as difficult as possible. That's the entirety of your job description. If you're a sysadmin, if you're in DevOps, if you're a cybersecurity professional, your entire job description can be summed up like this. You're making threat actors' lives harder. That's the entire point of what you're doing. You're making them spend more time, spend more effort, waste their time, waste their resources trying to breach stuff that they're ultimately not going to be able to. Until something breaks, and that's when you go into emergency mode. But you need to make it as difficult as possible because they don't really want to spend their time trying something that might not work when there are easier targets elsewhere. So you might just tire them out. You just need to wait them out.
Exactly. And for some reason, I'm reminded of a quote, I hope I don't get it wrong, from one of my favorite fiction stories. That was actually, I'm pretty sure the author was a cybersecurity person. Yeah, but it's a fiction story called Daemon, spelled in the Unix way, D-A-E-M-O-N. And in the book, said something along the lines of, there's three rules for perfect security. Don't use a computer, don't turn one on, and don't own one. Anything beyond that, you have risk.
And those are the three stories that we had for you today. All of them dealing with data and the ways that it can be breached, the ways that threat actors are trying to get to it, the ways that companies are abusing it, and the ways that companies don't assume that it's possible to be breached. That's the recurring theme for all of these stories. Again, zero risk doesn't exist. Like you just said, if you end up having to use a computer, if you have to turn one on, then you're at risk. You have to accept that that risk exists, but you don't have to make it easy for somebody to abuse that. Cover your bases, at least cover the basic stuff. This isn't easy. Nobody promised you that this job was easy. It's not. It's not easy. It requires constant vigilance. It requires you being always attentive and keeping up with new information and new stuff that's coming out every single day. That never ends. But it's possible to make life much, much difficult for the attackers and for the threat actors out there. Cover your bases and thank you very much for joining. If you want to read some ramblings from me, follow the TaxCare link in the description below. Sign up for the newsletter. I promise we'll have interesting stories for you if you do that. And again, thank you very much for everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.